Hi everybody, welcome to today's episode of No Killing Goblins. We're going to be covering chapters 2.31 and 2.32 of the second volume of The Wandering Inn. Dragonus is still under the weather, and I have a guest with me again. It's Lynette. Say hi, Lynette. Oh god, I said that wrong. Say hi, Lynette. That also sounded stupid. Say hi, Lynette.
Hi there, folks. How's it going?
So, it's the tail end of June now when we're recording this, because I'm trying to do clusters of episodes and stay ahead. We're pushing forward, trying to finish volume 2 so that we can restructure it a little bit for the next couple of volumes so that it's more arc-y and we have less episodes. It won't be as granular. But before we get digging into the chapters, how are you, Lynette? Welcome back. What has been up with you?
I am doing a lot better than I was, I think, the last time I talked to everybody. I am no longer nearly as exhausted as I was. Sleep is an amazing thing. Everyone should do it a lot. Naps, you know? Why don't we take naps? Naps are amazing. If you don't want your nap, can I have it? That'd be great. I'm in the hot season right now for my shop, and that means I'm cutting back on my hours a little bit, which means I get to sleep in, which is amazing. I'm loving it. Yes.
I hate work and life and all human beings today. I am here under severe protest to do this task, which is actually pretty serious because the chapters we're going to talk about are kind of deep.
Yeah.
They talk about faith and religion, blah, 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 blah.
We're just going to have to overcome all of that by just, you know what, guys? We're just going to hold Oshi down and we're going to smother him in hugs on the count of three. Okay, ready? 1, 2, mental hug.
Rawr. Okay. No.
Yep.
Okay. Anyway, thank you for being bubbly, Lynette.
You're welcome.
Like, that's going to help my dark mood. Ugh.
Contrast. You always want contrast, right?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Have you watched or read or done anything lately that's cool? Because I haven't. Well, actually, no, I take that back. I have. I did spend an afternoon chatting with somebody about anime, and we ended up making 3x3s, and then I brought that to the Discord. Which reminds me that I plan to do this a little bit later, but I think I should just do it as soon as I can convince Dragonus to sit down. I want my co-host back. It's a lot of, like, random people. And I love people. But, you know, Dragonus and I got into a...
We got a rhythm.
I don't have to think about it. I just shut up and Dragonus will just pick up the conversation. And if I'm tired, he knows when to pick up the slack. And I know when to do the same for him.
It's a partnership.
Yeah, back to the 3x3. So I was thinking of doing 3x3s for books. And then posting the 3x3s in one of the episodes. And we just sit around and discuss it. We talk about what our collection of literatures and that we enjoy. Or maybe just narrow it down to lit RPGs and books and all that stuff. And, you know, chat about it a little bit. Just as a cool summary episode. And then...
Things that we do other than TWI?
Sort of. But it'll be a 3x3 of all of the literature that we like. So novels, web serials, things like that, all together. Not movies or anime. Actual reading things.
Actual words.
Yes, where the words.
Yeah. I don't know. I've got so many favorites. I don't know how I could narrow things down to just 9 of them. I realize that this is a great way to just kind of take a peek into other people's brains and go, oh, that's what you like. Okay, really cool. Let me try that one. And you kind of share each other's enthusiasms and interests for a little while. And that's great. That's wonderful. But, oh my God, there's so many.
Well, the point is that the person gets to... I mean, it's like the Instagram of reading. So you get to cherry pick the ones that you want to represent you. Not necessarily you're like, oh my God, you have to read this. This is what I like. This is the kind of thing I like. These are the authors I like. Mm-hmm. This is the literature, right? I love 3x3s because they're a good snapshot. And that's all what they're supposed to be, a snapshot. And they let the person talk a little bit about the deep dives. Anyway, this is coming in a future episode. I just wanted to talk about it because I got nothing else, because I was really excited by it. Now I'm planning around how to do it and get the logistics. And I keep saving stuff, but Dragnus isn't here and I can't do it.
Hang on to it. It'll get used.
I'm sure.
We believe in you.
I'm sure.
You can do it.
The other big thing I want to talk about, so I think by the time this out, Pirate will have at least talked about publicly doing the rewrite for Volume 1.
Okay.
And it's come up on the on Fantasy Reddit, Our Fantasy, not just the TWI Reddit, but Our Fantasy as well, about what folks think of authors going back and rewriting their earliest works.
I saw that, and I can see both sides of the argument. So one side stated that it was, you know, as you write and as the years go by and as you improve, you should maybe go back and redo the first maybe not so smooth works that you had produced, so that, you know, maybe you actually can improve on what you've got out there in front of everybody else. And then on the other side, it's folks who are saying art, and this is art, writing is artwork. It's a snapshot of who the author was at that moment that they wrote it. Their belief system, it's their experiences. Maybe things change 15 years down the road and something happens that they no longer think that way anymore. But is it fair to have an author go back and whitewash or change what they used to believe or think about based off of a later interpretation of their own self, their own psyche? I don't know which one I like, honestly. I like good work, and I can still spot flaws in earlier pieces, but again, I'm sort of leaning toward the latter, I'll be honest. I don't want to, the history behind it of this is who I used to be, it's no longer who I am, but this is who I used to be, and letting everybody see that, you know?
That's not the only interpretation, and that wasn't really what bugged me in the conversation that's been going on.
Yeah?
With TWI's Volume 1 rewrite, and with that conversation in particular. So there's two aspects of it. A lot of the readers are coming from the context of seeing volumes of books rewritten. And their response is usually, I don't want to buy a new book version. I don't want you to go back to old stuff. I don't want retcons and rewrites and old things. I want new stuff. Stop going back. I already like you. You don't need to make anything else, was the impression I got.
Yeah.
And the other aspect of it being...
Saleability,
yes. The counter-argument to that, and why part of why Volume 1 is being rewritten, is that it isn't the best writing. It's not going to be the best writing because Pirate was still just getting started out, and so were a lot of writers. And oftentimes what can happen is, for example, I follow a writer I talk about often, Alona Andrews, and she and her husband talked a lot about how their first volume, they wrote a significantly larger portion, but because of the way first novels are handled by the big publishers, they had to cut nearly half the novel out in order to meet the standards that were set. The arbitrary standards, by the way. Everybody says that, well, this is the best way. No, it's not. It's all fucking made up. Because outside of economic limitations based on color and ink, everything else is just just the opinion of the publishers. Because there are plenty of other formats and ways to publish things, and people will buy it. Rant aside, what happens is that writers often have to do that. They have to rework their first volume to meet whatever standard they are told is the one that they have to. And it doesn't necessarily meet even the artistic standards of the writer in question.
Mm-hmm.
How can you judge accurately whether or not it's a good representation of the art? How can you judge if what the work is something that's of value if you're not even seeing the full work itself? You're just seeing a snapshot of the work that's been touched up by a bunch of editors and a lot of other people who helped along the way. And that can be a good thing, but that can also be a detriment. The other argument to this whole setup, the thing that's really bugged me, is that there is this tone that everybody seems to have where their first thing is, I love Pirate Abba. I love the new stuff. I hated Volume 1 when I started out. Why do we need to rewrite it?
they answered their own question there, didn't they?
Make the logic work, Lynette. Every single time it's the same thing.
You can't, okay, everyone's got opinions about how they feel about the beginning of a journey. You can go on a hiking trip, and the first 300 yards up a mountain are fine and beautiful, and you're looking around, and the last 300 yards at the very top of the mountain, you don't fucking care about the scenery anymore. Your legs are killing you. You haven't eaten in 3 hours. You really got to go pee. There are so many variables that affect your experience with the work, where you are in your life, what you've seen, what you've been going through, whether or not it relates to anything you talk about. Well, like the chapters we're going to be talking about today, too, there are this part of the book made me very uncomfortable. I didn't like reading it very much because it's sort of difficult. And is it necessary? Yes, it is very necessary for the entire series. And you just don't know that yet. You think that the author's just throwing something in here that, you know, oh no, they're going to be talking about, really? We're going to talk, oh, okay, can I fast forward this part? No, we need it. And sometimes that's hard to get through, and sometimes it's cringe, and sometimes it's laughable, and it's life, you know?
Right. But this topic could go on for, in fact, it might go on forever because I might just do another episode entirely about rewrites and what people feel about and how people feel about Pirates Rewrite, probably at the end of July, once they've gotten another chance to take a stab at it, because right now they've only done, what, 10 chapters? Maybe let them get to like 20, 30, and then we'll do like a check-in, see where volume one is and what changed.
And it's not even edited
It's
yet.
not.
The chapters that we're seeing are possibilities of what could get put into the new redo. And it hasn't even been to an editor yet. And to have the editor go through and say, nope, we don't need that. We don't need this. We don't know. Because right now it's the consumer making opinions about the work. And we have our opinions. We've all got our opinions.
Yeah, and the thing is about all this is that I kind of wish that the public didn't see how the sausage was made, because honestly, I understand why Pirate's doing it this way. They can't keep disrupting their own schedule and trying to maintain like four different projects at the same time. It's just not possible. And it's not like the Patreons are getting shortchanged and they're getting less chapters, but it's not like, what is it, one less book a month for $5? Screw you. No offense to anybody, but yeah, I'm fine with that. It's just revealing this process means that every single person is going to have yes, they're going to have their own opinions, but it's also going to be a lot of misinformed opinions because a lot of them don't pay attention to Pirate's author notes or to when they talk about the context of what they're doing or how they're doing it. So it's a lot of like uninformed opinions. That's what annoys me the most. Because you have pirates stating right off the start that this is going to be a flexible thing, that they're writing parts and trying to figure out the pieces that they need, and they're working on improving the prose and the language and the pacing and the tone and the flow of the novel.
And they've put their comments in the middle of the sections. As you're reading along, you've actually got a little blank area, and then suddenly pirates talking to you again about, okay, this is what I just did. I'm not sure if I like it. This is what I'm trying to do. And then you've got several paragraphs of them explaining, and then it cuts again and it goes back to the story.
And not one of the comments that I have read that irked me managed to read those parts, but they did manage to read them. Like, it is detestable
Oh, yeah.
how easily people are ignoring the fucking writer in favor of their own opinion without actually reading what the fuck is going on. Okay, you can see why I get heated about this.
I understand. I admire Pirate for trying to kind of pull back the curtain just a little bit because, on the one hand, yes, you have consumers who are maybe not as patient or appreciative of all of this work, but on the other hand, you've got a lot of writers or wannabe writers who are looking at the sausage making and going, oh, okay, well, huh, I don't know what I would do if I was in pirate shoes, or maybe I would do it this way. And the fact that Pirate is explaining a little bit more, I think is really encouraging for the other creatives that are following along. We just don't know how many there are, you know?
Because they don't, like, that's who I thought would be talking about it. Instead, I like Terry Art, but you shouldn't reveal him as a dragon. Because in Volume 1, he doesn't get revealed as a dragon, even though in the text there's a sentence that literally says he's a dragon. That didn't happen. You should not reveal that Rags is a human being, or sorry, is a sentient being, because it's such a big deal that nobody finds out that goblins are people, because they're supposed to be monsters until Aaron figures it out. The amount of the fact that they're, I don't know, wielding weapons and walking around and trying to that doesn't require any kind of development or mental acuity.
Yeah. You're going to see the most vocal ones, and the most vocal ones are usually the ones that don't listen very well, I'll be honest.
Or even read, apparently.
Maybe not. But also keep in mind that those creatives who are wanting to protect their soft inner bits probably also aren't reading the comments. I skip over the complaints whenever I go through Reddit and I'm like, okay, this is what they're wanting. This is what they're asking. This, you know, I'll put a comment up my own self and then I won't read everybody else's because I don't like how the negativity comes out. I will put my own little ray of sunshine out there for everybody to see and I hope it helps someone, but it might not. And I'm not going to read everybody else's just in case I get hurt. So that's an avoidance process of mine. And I am a creative. I don't write like Pirate does, but this is how I protect myself.
I understand that. And that's perfectly valid as reasoning. I dislike the path that the discourse is taking, because what happens is that there is a vacuum of writers and folks who are interested in the process itself and in what Pirate is doing. And instead, there's just a lot of, oh my God, no, don't take away my candy.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the problem with the internet. You've got places for people to bitch and they're going to do it.
I've said a lot of wild things in the last 15 minutes, so I'm going to shut up now and we're going to move on to talking about the chapters and saying wild things about them. So we're going to start on chapter 2.31, and it begins with bubbling cheese.
Most chapters should start with bubbling cheese, in my opinion. Fondue for everybody.
31 is a very interesting chapter because I think it's a very good example of Pirate learning the form of slice of life. I think it's coming into their own, mm-hmm. as far as understanding how to integrate like that slice of life thing and use it as a counterbalance against more powerful revelatory plot-based mm-hmm. writing, right? Because what we have here is Aaron creates pizza, immediately gets it stolen, mm-hmm. and then Holric visits the inn, and Holric wants some food, and she serves a bunch of stuff, and then she finally makes use of the fae flowers that she managed to swipe from the fae.
On the reread, I had forgotten that she could turn the flowers back into gold coins herself.
Yeah.
I had completely forgotten that she could do that. I was just expecting the nectar, which we did get, and you see such a vulnerable side of Holrock as well, which is just, oof.
It was very beautiful. So Pirate starts off with the kind of slice of life, oh, Holrock doesn't like the inn he's staying in. He's all grumpy and he wants a place to go visit. And Aaron's making food and doing all this. And then she's like, huh, I can do this if I squeeze a little bit in here. And boom. Epic scene, memory of Holrock's past. You see his vulnerability, his enjoyment, his life. And you get hit in the emotional heart. And then we come back to Aaron just like trying to keep him, prevent him from dying.
Wake up! I'm sorry! I need to kill you! No, please, get up!
I love that part so much. That was so good.
Just flaily panic. I didn't mean to choke somebody to death or something like that, you know?
I poison him, I think, was the thing. Or something like that, yeah. The juxtaposition of the tones and the way they're weaved together is just something that I really appreciated in this chapter, and I think Pirate did an excellent job with. Mm-hmm. And they did the same thing later when Pawn comes to the inn, using the subtle buildup of the more quiet relationship between Aaron and Pawn, and you notice the sublimation of that friendship that they're having into a more from Pan's point of view, you can see it as some as Eren being this epic figure granting her knowledge to Pan, while to Eren it's this friendship that she has with this very young person that doesn't necessarily know everything, and she's trying to comfort him and using what she knows, her faith, and giving it. And it's a really, really interesting way to show how the simplest of actions can cause the greatest of changes in children.
Yeah.
Not just children, but just people in general. Same thing with Holler. It was really well done.
My favorite part with the conversation with Pawn, and again, I'm going to reiterate, this is an uncomfortable conversation for me. I grew up in a Christian household, but we weren't Protestant, and we were in a very Protestant neighborhood, and I was told by my parents, by all the people at church, I'm like, okay, they said, don't argue with them whenever they start talking to you about God or Jesus or any of the rest of that. Don't argue with them. Listen politely. Say a couple of truths of your own if you feel like it, but, you know, don't get into it. Don't push. Don't. And so the fact that Aaron's doing a little bit of storytelling feels a lot like the proselytizing that I kept avoiding when I was small. And it made that same little squirmy feeling happen down in my gut. Oh, God, how do I get out of this conversation? I don't want to hear this. Yeah. So having Eren look at these people who don't know anything about what she's known all her life and then try to explain it in a couple of paragraphs, yeah, it's going to get a little weird and it's going to get a little wrong and it's going to, you know, be really fucking confusing. And you end up with what impressed me the most about Eren is that she put it forward as a story, and all of the questions that both Holrock and Pawn came up with, she never lied about anything she told them. If she didn't know, she said she didn't know. If she was confused about something, or, you know, she said, you know, this is what a lot of people think. And I like the fact that when Pawn is in distress and when he's hurting and when he's looking for answers and she doesn't have them, she tells him that she doesn't have them. And in my opinion, that's the best thing you can do with children. They need to know you're not perfect, but they also need to know that they're not alone in not knowing all of the answers. That was powerful for me when I read that.
It was a really controversial chapter when it was released as well, especially because it deals with faith and religion.
Mm-hmm.
Organized religion, especially, touching on Christianity is something of a no-no. And I know for a fact that Pirate actually rewrote the chapter a little bit to remove references to Jesus and to Christianity. And this isn't a spoiler. When I'm going to say this outright because Pirate's talked about this before. When it comes to the evolution of Pawn's faith, Pirate has been very careful to make it specifically rooted in Pawn's interpretations,
mm-hmm.
and separating it from Earth's faiths and Earth's liturgies and the way we conceptualize God and faith and our belief in a greater power, partly because of the reaction to this chapter, but also because it's very obvious that when you're touching on faith and you're involving a work of fantasy,
mm-hmm.
people tend to associate the two and believe that whoever is involving faith in their fantasy work is equating faith to fantasy. There's even a rule in our fantasy that I somehow came up against. I was commenting in this thread about what kind of works shaped literature, fantasy literature, and my first thought was the Bible. Western literature is heavily, for hundreds of years, was heavily shaped by the story of the Messiah. This is not me saying that it's an untrue story or anything, but that book, the Bible, and the parables and lessons from the Bible and the things that happen, and for me being Muslim, for the Quran and the Torah, these Abrahamic religions shaped our conception of the universe and thus shaped our ability to of what is real and what is not.
Mm-hmm.
That was important to imply, but all I said was the Bible, and I immediately got downvoted, and then I got a rule infraction because just stating that was enough to equate fantasy to fiction. And I think part of why Pirate was so careful was because of that thing. And I do like the way they've managed to navigate that issue pretty well, I think. At least in this chapter, I thought so.
The belief, the focus on heaven, and when he's walking home in the snow and he looks up at the stars, and for the first time in his life, he wonders what's beyond them. That also, the curiosity and the wonder and the what else is out there kind of question that is, echoing around in his head. And that's the kind of faith, because that is what faith is. Faith is things we can't see. We have to trust in things that we don't know for sure about. And faith is sometimes blind, but it doesn't have to be. And the wonder and the curiosity and the figuring things out as you go, I think this is when Pon starts to realize that he's not the only one who does that. He's not the only one who's going to be having these questions. And I am just so tickled that we get to see him go through some of it when a lot of us in our own personal lives have probably gone through it too. It was a really powerful moment, and I think it was a great ending to the chapter when he got his class.
It certainly was. On a more characterization level, this is, I think, Pon's crystallization as a person, because yes, he's sort of chosen to be a person, but prior to this chapter, he's never really found anything that made him go like, I choose this, you know? I don't know how else to conceptualize it, but it's like that moment of choice, because think about it. If the system as we know it is something that grants you classes based on your truths and your beliefs and your experiences, this means that in this moment, the system acts as a sort of punctuation point period to the line of, and then pawn the acolyte trade.
And it's an affirmation, It's the system looking down. And he had to have thought he was doing something right when the system speaks up in his mind and goes, now you're an acolyte. I would have taken that as a verification, as a, okay, I'm actually on a path that other people have tread before. Let's follow it and see how high I can get with this. But finding the path in the first place is never easy. I don't think it's ever meant to be easy, and it wasn't for him.
And it's never supposed to, you're right, it's never supposed to be easy. Figuring out who you are is hard enough, but then figuring out who you are in the context of the entire world and whether there's a greater power or not, it's such a difficult thing. But I mean, unless you have any other comments, we can move on to Pirate's author note for this and then the comment section, which got very spicy.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and I think I'll pull out a few comments and we can discuss them. But if you want to take a few minutes, we can also like let the recording go while you read over stuff. So that'll be fine if that's okay with you.
Well, as far as the comments,
Yes.
no, I'm gonna ostrich and stick my head in the ground on that one too. I'm
Okay, so
good.
I'll pick some stuff up. As far as the author note for this one goes, they talk about, so Pirate talks about being burnt out from Saturday. A part of this chapter felt weaker, and then I never know how a good chapter is until I get my comments. To the most important part, I always loved Prince of Egypt. Forgetting religious discussions, I just like the artistry of the movie. But then I love The Hunchback of Notre Dame for pretty much the same reason. So Pirate liked The Prince of Egypt and The Hunchback of Notre Dame. And I'm gonna tell you right now, The Hunchback is one of my favorite Disney films because it has my favorite song in it. God Save the Outcasts. Have you ever heard it?
Yes, I have.
Oh my God. It's an ensemble piece, and technically it's supposed to be Esmeralda's like solo piece or whatever, but really it's just so beautiful, and I think
It's a commentary too on the commercialism of religion, and I ask for wealth, I ask for fame. And she says, I ask for nothing. I can get by just fine like I am, but I want God to help other people.
right, and that is supposed to be how Christianity is supposed to work, and faith is supposed to work. You pray for others, you ask of, all the good shit. And then there's this wonderful juxtaposition against the kind of swan song pieces that comes up with Quasimodo, and then Hellfire, oh my God, Hellfire.
And you had kind of the same thing with Moses, and when she tells the story about Moses, because Moses in the story grew up as, wealthy and privileged and socially elite, and then he turns around and he discovers all of these different truths, and then instead of running away screaming off into the night or, offing himself in despair, he decides to use everything he's learned and everything he has to help the people that he now knows are his. And that lesson, I think, Pawn internalizes, but because he's not Moses, he's still at a loss as to how exactly he should go about helping his people. He's just a worker. He's just himself. How does he do all of these amazing, wonderful things? And the answer to that is literally just one day at a time, slice of life.
Yeah, I agree. So, in the comments section, gird your loins, Lynette.
Okay.
So, there is a person named Dark D who, on May 31st, right after this, I think it was published around May 31st, says, "Did we really have to bring Christianity into this story? I hope it won't have a heavy presence. If so, it's like politics. You just don't go there, mainly because now you have to take sides and reveal your own personal stances on everything." And Pirate Abba wrote a response to this, which I think I'm going to read. I'll paraphrase because it's fairly long. It's four paragraphs, fairly long. So Pirate Abba wrote, "To reply to this and other comments, it's my hope that my personal opinions don't go into the characters I write as much as their own personalities and beliefs influence how they deal with religion. I have my own opinions, true, but what I write into my stories is never necessarily what I believe should be true. There are many authors who use religions, fake or based on real ones, American Gods, the Kushiel's Dart series, even books like The Wheel of Time. The only difference is the degree of separation from actual religions or the way they're presented as clever parallels, commentaries, and so on. I know Christianity, even broadly defined, is a sensitive topic, but it is a very real part of our world, and people have multiple perspectives on it, just like politics. That Erin talks about Christianity is a reflection of demographics. If she weren't American, she might be Buddhist or Muslim." We'll talk about that in a second, but my job is to try and integrate anything I use into a story engagingly and creatively, even religion. But calling any one side wrong is a terrible choice as an author. You should portray the character's opinions, not your own, when you write. We'll see how other people react and how I manage to deliver on this concept as the story goes on. So before you react, I have one thing to say. Oh, I know that the majority religion, the majority faith in the US is Christianity, not including the half of all Americans who just don't, have a particular affiliation. But oh boy, that one hit me. You know more non-Christians than you think, is all I'm gonna say. And on the other aspect of this, the pushback to this, and I won't read the other commentary on this. Most of it boiled down to, it's just a story. It's not just a story. It's the author's opinion because they're the one writing it, and it's their, words, and clearly it matters because if it didn't matter, why would we read it, right? That about sums up a lot of the opinions. I don't know if I agree.
I've got a statement on that one, actually.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
So before I found The Wandering Inn, I could go through novels. I could read two novels a day. I could sit down and I could gobble down these light little fantasy nuggets in 4 or 5 hours, and my book is done, and I go take it back to the library, and I literally forget what it was because they're all predictable. You've got a main character who always does everything perfectly, who always does everything right, and I could see what the author wanted me to see because it was preachy sometimes. I could see that this particular character who was perfect, who was meant to be me, and this is what the character believed, which meant that I was meant to believe that. It was so tiring. I don't know if there's a better way to put that, because I could read a book And by the time I was halfway through, I could tell you how it was going to end. I could tell you who they were going to fall in love with. So much of it was just so damn predictable. And I think we're what, halfway through volume two at this point? Is it, were you at the halfway point? Most readers who are coming into The Wandering Inn, if they weren't longtime readers, if they weren't reading this as it was released, most people who are now coming into The Wandering Inn are blazing through the chapters. And by the time you get to the middle of volume two, you still think that pirates like other authors. You still don't quite see how pirate is going to surprise you and how capable they are to turn the tropes around or, lead you down a path that is just so flippin' obvious. And then, whoop, nope, there's a side shoot. We're not going to take that path at all, as a matter of fact. My admiration for their ability to, like they said, put forth how Aaron sees religion rather than how Pirate does. This was really well done.
Okay, there is another aspect of the chapter that was oddly controversial that I didn't even know about until after I read the comments. A person named Perspective on June 4th, 2017 wrote, "I'm actually surprised no one really complained about the ethnocentrism in the story before now. And by ethnocentrism, I mean the implicit belief that one's own culture, American, in brackets, culture is inherently superior to all other cultures, real and fictional. Ethnocentrism keeps showing up in the story, i.e., when Aaron introduces some piece of American culture to the locals and they instantly drop their own culture to praise the American thing. Examples of this include all the American food, like ice cream and hamburgers and pizza, along with the American music Aaron sings. In fact, I have very little impression of the pinnacles of local culture in this story, because each of these pinnacles seems to immediately be eclipsed by something American that Aaron introduces." And then they go into a lot of very detailed stuff about Celine Dion. Like, there's a bunch of shit. And how jarring it was, and unintended consequences, and all that. And there's back and forth, and people talk about it. Okay, so this talks about food, which is the only reason I'm even mentioning it. Because generally I wouldn't do it. But yeah,
Sure you wouldn't. Okay.
so the ethnocentrism bit, it's unavoidable. Because, take for example, anime and their association with Japanese culture and its superiority. If you look at Korean works or Chinese works or English works or French or anything, there's always, my culture is better, this is why it's amazing. Because the audience wants to feel good about it. And I think Pirate did a reasonable job of making it not too bad. And this isn't too spoilery to say one of the things that I never said it out loud, but one of the reasons why I campaigned so much to have a diversity of food was because it fought this kind of ethnocentrism. If you diversify the point of views that you're looking from, then there isn't a particular side that is shown as better than all the rest. It's just new food being introduced, and it's a fad that people enjoy for a while, and then they integrate into their own culture and adapt it to what they do. And I was hoping Pirate would take, of course they took the hint and, ran with it, but that's because they're a good writer. But yeah, that's what I was looking at it from. And I didn't feel like comfortable attacking that particular subject because it's a sensitive one, you know?
It is, and as an American, I'm agreeing with the fact that, most of us who live here, the country's so big, we don't really see a reason sometimes to ever leave it. So, we're gonna do a 2 month road trip. It's only going to be in our borders because it's gonna take approximately 2 months to drive around just inside our borders. Yes, you're going to experience several different cultures when you do that, but it's not going to be going to see France. It's not going to be going to see the Great Wall of China. You're not going to go to Egypt. It's not going to, there's all these other things you're not going to know about or see or understand about people being people, no matter where they are. But as a 20-year-old girl from Grand Rapids, Michigan, Erin has probably, I mean, other than the chess tournaments, I don't think she got out much.
I don't think so either. And that's what makes it what it is, you know? But that's all we'll talk about because I need to talk about food, and we discuss the two major things. There's a lot of other constructive criticism and not so constructive criticism. For example, the person who went, this story has definite take work for, definitely taken a turn for the worse. Religion, way to introduce more side conflicts and suffering in an already conflict-torn world. Okay, we're gonna move on to the second chapter, which is 2.32H. And it's both a stark departure from the last chapter's sort of heavy, ominous nature, which is leavened by the quieter moments, to I don't even know what to describe it other than it's the rebirth of the horns. That's all it is. It's hugely important from a character standpoint, and yet it's
I've got a question for you on that one. In the beginning, we've got a scene from Saria and her getting up and going about her day and some of the thoughts she's been having. We've got a scene from Yvonne and her, oh, honey, she is depressed. Oh, my goodness, someone get this girl a therapist. And then we've got a scene from Pisces, and we still need to ring his bell a little bit, I think, and actually make him see a little bit of the wider world in a different light. And then we see Aaron, and we've only got like four paragraphs of Aaron. Now, let me ask you, after seeing those three, do you think the Aaron bit was put in there for levity or because she's sort of an unofficial member of the Horns?
I think it's because she's their patron. Aaron has always been the patron of the Horns, to me. Ryoka comes and goes, but it's Aaron that fed them, clothed them, gave them peace, helped them out. In this case, I'm speaking to the exact members that exist now, not the pre-slaughter Horns.
Right.
And she still has a fairly deep tie to Calrus, and to Gariel, and to the, I forget the mage's name.
There were a couple.
It starts with an S.
Sostrum.
Yeah. Sostrum, yes. So she has a deeper connection to the original horns, and she develops a deep connection to the horns as they exist now. She helps Syria in her recovery after the destruction of the horns. I mean, she's basically Pisces's why he's not living in a hovel. That's all I got. Like, yeah. And you get to see how Kissaver is introduced to these three folks and the surprise news that he's been tossed out of his hive, which has never happened before. He's considered nothing, and he hooks up with these three other.
And he's missing an arm.
And he's missing an arm.
He's still bleeding. He's dizzy. He's shaking. And then 30 minutes later, he's helping them fight a whole bunch of goblins. I'm like, this kid has so much adaptability, and I am just absolutely flabbergasted that they just kicked him out just because, you know. I'm like, why? Why did you even do that?
What happens here is the formation of this group is, first off, all of the things that becomes foundational to the horns happens in this fucking chapter. Like, they go headfirst into a fight, save a bunch of people. They're pathetic and messy and weird, and they have bone hands and broken hands and fucked up brains, and they're like a bunch of losers.
Yeah, but Yvonne grabs Pisces by the collar and hauls him up out of the chair and says, "This is our job. This is what we do. We go help people." And out the door they went. He didn't even, you know, he didn't even bitch about it that much. He understood. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to get at. Like, the bond that they form, it's fragile, but it's there from the start. And the reason Erin is part of it is because she was part of establishing that bond for them. And she will be a patroness, but she will never be part of the Horns. I think it's a reflection of Pirate's process for integrating other perspectives and other stories into this one. I always talk about Pirate's writing process as like a Scheherazade-style story within a story, where this might be Erin's story, but within Erin's story, there's 100 others, and this is one of them, the rebuilding of the Horns, the personal story of Yvonne Byers, Pisces, Do we know his last name at this point?
No, we don't.
No, we don't. No, we don't.
Not
so
yet.
Pisces, the Necromancer, and Sirius Springwalker, and Kissenver, the Prognugator, or at least former Prognugator of the Free Hive of the Antinium. This is the origin story of the Horns of Hammerid as they are in the story. And fuck yeah, it's a pathetic start, but I love it.
And going back and doing the reread, I'm sitting here and I caught myself drumming my heels on the floor in excitement because I'm looking at all four of them sort of looking at each other with suspicion, and Evlon is frowning at both Pisces, and then, you know, they almost draw a weapon on Kissimver, and Aaron almost speaks up, and then something comes in out of nowhere, and I'm looking at this going, oh, this is a moment.
Oh, and just to clarify, these guys could die at any time. We just like this start.
Mm-hmm.
Remember this, Pirate Abba has a very sharp quill, and they do kill people.
Blood everywhere.
Yeah. Okay, this isn't a hint or anything, I'm just saying, just don't get too attached. We are just obsessive pirate readers, and we just like certain parts, even if it ends up tragic. Because remember, I'm also the person who loved the fact that the chess club died.
You monster. You absolute evil person, you.
It was epic. I thought it was great. I still think it's great. I do wish at least Knight had survived, because that was a really cool guy. But yeah, I was happy. I mean, they got slaughtered. It was a really emotional scene.
Hey, everybody, are you with me? I don't think I'm going to talk to Oshi anymore. Are you with me?
I don't think I really had any critiques for the chapter or any kind of structural points, because it was a fairly straightforward structure, right? Pirate let it flow well.
Yeah, the more I'm looking at it now, the introduction to the three different characters and then a fourth scene where it's just a couple of paragraphs of Aaron making pancakes and she's not even thinking about anything in particular. I'm like, I don't even know why this is here. I don't get it. I'm going to go with the whole pirate needed us to look at these three miserable people and then turn around and see something happy. And pancakes are happy.
Okay, you know what? You're missing something.
What am I missing?
There's an easy answer to that. So what was the paragraph right before that? What was the last line before that?
Oh, you're going to make me go back and look. Hang on.
He had no friends, not even Springworker. Not really. Not anymore. But it had always been this way. And then we flip to Aaron.
Yeah.
It's literally Pirate going, bitch, Aaron's your friend. Shut the fuck up. Jesus Christ. Literally, Aaron's making maple syrup pancakes, which he will devour, and she will feed him, as if he's not her friend. Like, what the fuck is wrong?
Here's a question for you. When Pisces leaves to go to the bathroom and Saria starts telling everybody else, including Aaron, exactly how good of a mage he is, and everyone is shocked. Do you remember the first time you read this? Were you shocked?
By what?
By Pisces' competence.
No.
Why not?
He made Torin. He made Torin. He made a construct. He's always demonstrated that he has magical capabilities. And even Syria, from the start, says that he's a capable person. And Syria is 60 years old and has been adventuring a lot longer than everybody else. So when she says something, I believe her.
Mm.
You're asking me if I believe in the competence of Pisces, the necromancer, like Ryoka's fucking foot got healed by? Come on.
Well, and this is the thing. I had all of that in front of me. I had all of that I've already experienced. And then Pisces himself shows up and you forget he's competent.
That's because I think I'm the only one who thinks about the world in terms of masks, because everybody has a front-facing mask and everybody has the truth of themselves. And I just assume that whoever you meet for the first time is the mask, and then you have to work for them to be comfortable enough to take off that mask and just be real with you.
And this is why you yelled at me the first time I recorded on the podcast, right?
Yeah, I just, like, I worked really hard to get you to the point where I was happy to have the giggly person who makes ridiculously terrible jokes.
I make terrible jokes that are really innuendo heavy, folks, in case you wondered.
Fuck. Oh, no, there's no innuendo. I think, yes, last night.
Sometimes there's a lot of innuendo. You shut up.
Last night was like
shut up. If they want to know, they can come on the Discord and they can, you know, get me the innuendo right at them my own self. It'll be fine.
I'm just saying, like, Pan Spoilers is literally called the sewer of the Discord because of people like you. Literally, they named you. And that's the person I wanted on the podcast. And I got Happy Giggly Girl.
Because it was the first time all the podcast listeners were meeting me. And it was a mask. You are right.
Yeah.
I wanted them to like me. I wanted them to think that I was relatively harmless. I think I only fooled maybe half.
Okay. Serious mask on for just a second.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, reducing yourself so that they will like you, that pisses me the fuck off because I did that a lot.
Yeah.
Like, I would ask stupid questions that were easy to answer because then I would want the person to feel better about themselves. I would, like, there's a lot of stuff that I would do to make myself smaller. Like, fuck that shit. Just be you. I want to like you. And honestly, if you don't want to get to know me, if you aren't the kind of person who's willing to take the time to see what a person is like, then you're not a person I want to know in the first place. And Aaron, the reason I liked Aaron and the reason I liked the inn and all the story is because Pirate seems to favor the kind of folks who look a little deeper.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. Let's move on because I'm not getting too much more serious than that. But good chapter, right? Good chapter.
Oh, yes. Very good.
Okay.
We had fighting. There was blood. There were explosions. It was great.
I mean, I've said it before. Blood, explosions, jokes, and grief and tears. my literary orgasm. All it needs is a little bit of sex and some horrific queer, like, not horrific, so just queer stuff. And a tiny slice of horror or depression. And it's like, great. I'm happy. Like, that's it. But Pirate writes, they say, sometimes I think I've made a terrible mistake. Sometimes I think I've written too much, added too many characters, or I'm just taking this story too slowly. But then I remember if stop laughing!
I'm dying! Okay, I'm good, keep going. Sorry.
But then I remember if I was, you'd all let me know loudly and repeatedly in the comment section. Right? Question mark.
Well, they're not wrong.
I want to learn how to economize violence so I can convey the fraught lives of an adventurer without telling you for 5 pages how it felt as Yvlan locked blades with a hob. This is my best foot forward. Maybe I'll even let people vote on whether they want a Ryoka, Eren, Rags, Torin, Horns of Hammerhead, etc. story next. It'd be interesting to do once maybe, and I can always change the plot elements to go slower and faster. I regard writing as organic, and if you can't mess with the plot, that's probably a problem. Too much talking. Sorry. Thanks for reading. So this is the origin, I think, the development of the internal Patreon polls. Mm. So this is another step. So far they've developed to the point where they actually do the polls, and now they're thinking over how to structure the plot so that they can curate the choices that people will have in those Patreon polls that we do nowadays. So I've had discussions about the polls and how they influence the story, and I've had disagreements about it before. It's not that big a deal to me. I've never felt like the story is significantly altered because Pirate writes the plot that they want to write. If they didn't want to write something, they wouldn't put it on the polls, right?
Yeah, we would not have it as an option if Pirate didn't think that they could write about it.
Not even could. They plan to write about it. It has to be something that they're thinking about and they're planning, and they wouldn't put it on the poll if they genuinely didn't plan to write about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. That's all I'll say, and we'll just move on from that. I don't think I have any comments that were particularly jumped out at me. I didn't actually read a lot of the comments. Oh, right. Hold on. Him on June 6th says, the average amount of words is seemingly really around 10,000. It's hard to imagine that it was once 4,000 to 6,000. I'm curious if we're going to see 20,000 chapters in the future. How long do you even need to write such a gigantic chapter? And the response to that from Rin was, are you trying to murder our dear author?
Oh, no.
Oh, that's not even... Oh, no. It's not done. And then Pirate, after they go back and forth a little bit, says, I don't believe I'll ever move past 10,000 words, and I might try to bring it back down to 6 to 8K in the future. It takes me roughly 7 to 8 hours to write 10K chapter, and I often do it in one sitting if I'm out of time, which is again usually the case.
Oh, wow, they've gotten faster then.
Yeah, they've gotten significantly faster, and their perception of time has been warped because.
We knew
Yeah.
that.
All right, so after we laugh at Pirate.
We laugh and we send kisses and we send a massage therapist and yeah.
So there is another thing where Pirate answers some questions, and I want to read that part. So Ian Oliver Kamewit?
Yeah, Ian Oliver Kamowit.
You want to read it?
Sure.
Save my voice.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Hi, it's my first time posting, and I gotta say, I love, love, love your story. You nailed the pacing right, and you made me love your characters. Congratulations. I just have a few questions, though. First, do you have an ending planned for this book? An overarching plot resolution? And how long do you estimate will this web novel be? Second, about the elves, the characters mentioned that elves died long ago, like 1,000 years, and Saria is half elf as she's only 60 years old. I feel like there's something wrong here. Could you please explain, or will it be spoilery? Anyway, love your work, and I'll be following this till the end. Ian, I hope you still are.
Yeah, like I want to know if Ian's still following. I feel like we need to find Ian.
Hey, Ian, send us an email.
All right. So Pirate's response was, "Hey, thanks for posting and reading. I'm glad you like the story and you've got some questions I can answer in vague but hopefully helpful terms. I have the overall plot in my head, but the journey might be longer than I thought at first. That's a good thing. The story is sometimes organic and takes twists and turns I didn't predict, but there are a lot of things I do factor into each chapter as I write. In terms of length, it really depends on readers. I love the story and I could write one as long as the famous web serial Worm or even longer. On the other hand, if interest declines, I can begin the wrap-up phase sooner or so. It will depend on whether I can continue to tell a great story all the way through." And this is the important part for me. In terms of elves, yes, they died out thousands of years ago. Not telling how many thousands, but a long time. And Ciri is 60 years old, which is young in terms of a half-elf's lifespan, 300 years max. But she grows up fast like a human would, so she's old and experienced, but she's still young, caught between the perception of two heritages. Hope that helps. Thanks for reading. So the elf comment was interesting, considering maybe it's a retcon to the current version.
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah. I'm saying it out loud because hopefully Pirate will listen to this and they'll, remember that they wrote this and try to make sure that they clarify it for official reasons. Okay, but that's our episode. I hope you had fun listening to us. And before we leave, I don't have answers. Nobody's commented or sent an email, unfortunately, so I got nothing to read. But we'll try another question. Maybe somebody will talk to us. For me, here's my question. Concerning how religion was introduced in The Wandering End, do you think it was done organically? What did you think of it? What did you think of religion's introduction to The Wandering End? How about you? You got one for them, Lynette?
A question for them?
Yeah.
Oh, what do you think Aaron told Kissimver that the horns did not hear? In order to get him to calm down and stop shaking, what do you think she would have said in order to keep him from freaking out and possibly going aberration inside the inn?
Okay, that's a good question. Thanks for listening, everybody. Say bye, Lynette.
Bye. Thank you. See you later.
You've been listening to No Killing Goblins.
Edited by Discanter.
The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at No Killing Goblin or email us at nokillinggoblins with an S at gmail.com.